Those kids at Colton, they're kind of groovy, aren't they? You've probably read about this, and we discussed it on the show. Colton University and the student union have banned the pro-life club. They've said there's no funding for you, and you can't meet on campus anywhere. Now, let's put this in context. You, of course, fund university education. I do, you do. It costs a lot of money. We have to do it, and I don't begrudge that. And then the students who go to the university have to be part of a student's union, whether they like to be or not. They have to put extra money into the union. So a lot of money goes into this student union. And then the student union turns around and says, if you're pro-life, you can't really have any facilities here, and we're not going to give you any of your money back. But you know what? It's not about the abortion issue at all. It's about a group of publicly funded authoritarians who want their views to be impressed and imposed on other people. This will apply, I think, shortly to pro-Israel clubs, to pro-conservative clubs, pro-Christian, pro-Muslim. It's about a form of fascism, really, isn't it? Intolerance. And universities, colleges, further in higher education, that's where freedom of speech and opinion and debate should be welcomed and encouraged, but not at Colton. Any longer a university, or just a place for indoctrination? You decide. Michael Curran Show, join me. Good evening. Welcome to the Michael Curran Show. We try to listen to you out there. Well, sometimes not. I just ignore you because I'm that sort of person. But try to listen. And there are various shows that get a huge amount of response and feedback. We covered creation evolution, which frankly you don't see discussed fairly on most television programs in this country. We covered the issue about 2 months ago. Hundreds of emails. Please do it again. Didn't want to just bring back the same people, so we've brought a panel together, well, just two people to debate this subject, two new people, and I think you might enjoy it. So let's get on with it. Jason Wiles, who's manager of the Evolution Education Research Center at McGill University. Thank you for coming here all that way from, is it a province or a nation? I'm never entirely sure. And Lawrence Giselle, who's president, Creation Science Association, Quebec. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin with you. Creation and evolution. I mean, does anyone believe in creation in, what, 6 days? Does anyone believe that anymore?
Well, if you look at the surveys done, whether it's in the U.S. or Canada, 50% of the population believe in creation in 6 days. And you have another 35% that believe at least man was created, 35 to 40%. And then you have that 9 to 15% that believe exactly what's taught in our school manuals. So sure, there's a lot of people that do. I know many, many people. I know many scientists that do. I myself am in the science field, and I know many people who are. I have lists here of scientists, biologists, physicists, geologists that are creationists. And they believe in a six-day. Now, there's a lot of variety within the creationist movement, of course. Some people believe in an old universe, young Earth. Some people believe... The main focal point, of course, of the intelligent design movement is that there is a creator. And so we start there. Is there or is there not a creator?
Well, I mean, I declare my position immediately. I believe in creation. I believe God created everything. I don't believe that the Earth is, what, 6,000 years old? Is
that under 10 years.
I find that difficult to reconcile with scientific discovery and breakthrough in the past 100, 150 years. Is there a problem for you there?
Well, no, because I don't interpret the discoveries in the same way. You know, if I have a fossil here, we have fossils. They don't come with a date on them. You can't date a fossil. There's no way of dating a fossil. You have to use igneous rock. You can't use sedimentary rock. All fossils are sedimentary rocks. There's no dating method. And there's some very big issues with dating methods. If we take a look at the Grand Canyon has three layers in it. The Cambrian layer, which is supposed to be around 600 million years old, 500 to 600 million years old. And then right on top of it is the Carboniferous. I'm thinking of the French name because I always speak in French.
Hey, I can barely cope with English, so don't worry about that.
Cambrian, and then there's the Carboniferous layer, and then there's the Permian. Now, there's 150 million years, evolutionary years, between the Cambrian and the Carboniferous layer. And they're not there. They're just not there. 150 million years is lacking. It goes right. You can't even put a paper between the layers. They're flat. There's no erosion. There's something wrong with the dating methods. And there's a lot of reasons for believing the Earth is young. On my website, creationinfo.com, we have information on that, and on my French website also. There's short-term comets. We can't explain why they're there. They have to be under 10,000 years old. The comets, Halley's Comet, etc., you know, it gets smaller each time it goes around the sun. So within 10,000 years, it's not there. They say, well, there's an Oort cloud that might give them. Yeah, we've never found the Oort cloud. We've been looking for it since 1940. There's other evidence. The electromagnetic field around the Earth, it's diminishing 7% every 100 years. So if you go back 100 years, 100 years, 100 years, well, you get, within 20,000 years, you have the electromagnetosphere of a star. In fact, it would be so strong that it would dissolve the core of the Earth 20,000 years ago. So let's forget dinosaurs disappearing 65 million years ago. You don't even have an Earth 20,000 years ago. And there's no cycle in the electromagnetic field that's that short. We're talking 20,000 years is nothing.
In my research on this, the vast majority of scientists, people who are objective, I'm not talking about militant secular zealots, the vast majority, including people who are quite Orthodox Christians, the vast majority say there is no way the Earth is 10,000 years or less old. It is much, much, much older than that. Would you agree that is a majority opinion of most people in the scientific field?
In the scientific, yeah, sure.
They're all wrong?
What would Galileo's argument be? It's not majority.
He's not here, he's not going to come on the show
no,
either.
But what I mean
I showed
is
him the instruments.
Yes, but you showed him the Galileo, it's not majority that decides what's right. What is right is right.
And we're not talking about democracy here, though. We're talking about a huge number of people in the field who don't particularly have an axe to grind. Some of them, quite a few in fact, I'm surprised how many, are Christians.
Sure.
And I'm not talking about liberal Protestants, but people who really believe in their faith.
But I know many, many. I mean, I can come up with a list of hundreds of scientists that do agree with it. So there's a variety of...
Come on, be honest now.
I am honest.
Most science departments, almost every science department throughout the world, very few people would have your point of view.
That is true. That doesn't mean it's right. I can sit down. I've done 15 debates. I can sit down 800 conferences. I've talked with many, many evolutionists. I have questions they never answer. We'll see today. Maybe they will. I have questions that they never, ever answer. And they go into some. They go right off science into some kind of religion. You see, when we talk millions of years and billions of years, we're not talking science. Science is in the area of what's observable and by experiment. I have here the definition from the Oxford Dictionary. It says what is in the physical world that we can observe and we can experiment, repeat. Outside of that, it's a belief system. Whether it's right or not, it's a belief system.
Last question before the break. 1 million years BC with Raquel Welch. Was that her best movie?
You didn't see the movie.
You should. Back in a few moments, shaped my childhood. On the Michael Curran Show, we're here the other side. Lots more time, lots to say, don't you dare go. Imagine Michael Carranza, I hope you haven't evolved in that commercial break. No more comments like that. I gave him one full segment. Go ahead, sir.
Well, I think it's probably customary for someone to thank you at this point for bringing you on the show. And you have been a very gracious host, but I got to be honest, I really did not want to do this. I did not want to come today. Because debates like this, these public debates, kind of give a false impression to the people who are watching that there must be some type of scientific debate going on. And that's just not the case. There is no serious debate within the scientific community about the occurrence of evolution. That's not something that's going on. Now, I know that Lawrence will probably talk about the debates that he's had, right? And we have to be honest about this. He's not being invited by faculties of science to bring new information from this idea of creation science, which is an entirely, it's a misnomer, right? So this is not an area of discovery that they're bringing him in to talk about, right? These are not scientific debates. These are usually other groups, creationist groups that are asking and inviting the creationist speakers to come in. The faculties of science are not teaching anything to do with creation science or any type of creationism. That's not what science does. I believe Lawrence gave you a definition of science, and I think it very correctly limits science. I can't read it.
It's quite a cheat sheet there, has it?
Yes, he does. It says It's the structure and behavior of the physical and natural world, right? So that's what science limits itself to. It doesn't go to spiritual belief systems. It doesn't go to religious text to try to find out what the answer is first and then go and find whatever might support that, ignoring everything else. This whole idea of young earth creationism is not supported by science, like you were talking about earlier. There is no scientific information that would counter evolution in the way that Lawrence claims that it does, and there is no evidence for the Earth being young. These things are not found in science. There is no debate in science. Now, my debate skills shouldn't also be taken to be something that determines this, because no matter how I do on this show, and I know that Lawrence has a series out that says how to debate an evolutionist and never lose, right? So he may very well take the room on debate skills, but it doesn't make any kind of point as to whether or not there is a debate in science.
That, by the way, is a wonderful debating point to use that you just had, so you should bring out your own video, how to beat evolutionists. Anyway, the point he made, though, and we'll get onto the content and evidence or lack of, that majority opinion doesn't really mean anything intellectually. Majority opinion can believe all sorts of mythology. And maybe 100 years ago, 150 years ago, the majority of scientists in a university would have had the opposing point of view. Does that have any effect on truth, the fact that the majority of scientists today would support your position?
Well, I think you have to ask yourself, why does the majority think this way? And I think that's because the data supports it. Now, he's mentioning lists of hundreds of scientists. I assume that he's talking about particular lists of... is this the Discovery Institute list, Lawrence, that you're
talking
about?
That's only one of many.
Well, we can talk about that.
I have three pages here, biologists with full credentials. That'll
make interesting television. Reading out long names with long credentials.
Sure, but the point here is that science isn't done by a show of hands. We don't have a conference, say, and say, oh, okay, well, we have this interesting scientific question. Who thinks it's this? And everyone raises their hands. Okay, who thinks it's this? Everybody, oh, well, more people think this, and that's the way reality really is. No, it's actually borne out by the data. And you can have a minority opinion if it is supported by the data. Mm-hmm. And then you have a point to come with on that minority opinion. But the people that are on these lists many times are signing things. The statements that generate these lists are worded very carefully. They'll say, oh, well, we're skeptical about natural selection as being the only mechanism or a mechanism or something like this, right? Well, there are lots of mechanisms that are perfectly natural and perfectly supported by science, but the way these things are worded, it's kind of tricky. A lot of these, especially the Discovery Institute list that I'm sure Lawrence is familiar with and is touted often as being an anti-evolution list of scientists. Mm-hmm. But it's really worded so that an ardent evolutionist could sign that, being perfectly understanding in their own idea that, yes, of course, evolution is supported by the data, but this particular statement fits right in with my nature for skepticism of all things and also my knowledge that there are other mechanisms.
You mentioned religion. I understand that science is not meant to be religion-based, and I think most people would agree with that. But some would argue that science has become a religion in itself, that in the race to expunge religion or religiosity from science, scientism, in a way, it has become an alternative form of worship. So a scientist will do anything to avoid any belief in God, any reference to God, any reference to a sacred text. Are you being completely objective now in the scientific field?
Me personally, science in general. Right. Well, see, the thing about science is it doesn't say anything one way or another on the existence of God or what God may or may not do. Now, there are individual scientists, right? Scientists who will say, oh, no, there is no God. That's not a scientific statement. Scientists will say, oh, yes, I believe in God. That's not a scientific statement either. Science is completely silent on the issue of God, religion, right? If you are doing something and the results of what you are doing depend upon your personal belief or disbelief in God or religion, if your results depend on that belief, then what you're doing isn't science.
Is it possible that a number of people in a scientific field come to the table, as it were, with a disbelief in God, and that does influence their findings?
I don't know if it would influence their findings.
Their approach?
Perhaps. Now, I think you could say the same of people who have a Christian background,
yes,
who approach science and say, well, my Christian belief leads me into a direction of serving mankind in such a way that I want to scientifically study the nature of a disease, mm-hmm. right? So in serving man and serving God, they would certainly be scientific and materialistic in their methodology.
Right,
but maybe their motivation is out of their own Christianity or whatever religion it happens to be.
They've been very nice to each other. When we come back, they'll start being really cruel and nasty. That's what we want. Back in a few moments on the Michael Curran Show. What's the commercial convention, Dave, aren't we? Back to Michael Curran Show, Creation, Evolution. We've brought the debate back, popular demand. But you heard what the man had to say. You might as well just leave at this point.
I don't think so. As far as I'm concerned, I'm here to tell you, Michael, this morning, and Jason, evolution is dead. Long live the creator. I'll tell you why. And I'm saying science says that as a scientist. Evolution is dead because there's such thing as the minimal gene set concept. They've taken a mycoplasma, smallest organism, Mycoplasma genitalium, which is the smallest organism that is known to exist, has 468 genes. A gene is a mix of proteins, right? Mm-hmm. A list of, so it can be 1,000, can be 10,000 amino acids. Okay, there are 486, and they've decided since year 2000, they've said, let's try to reduce it, because we have to start, if you're going to be an evolutionist, you have to start with zero genes and build up if you're going to go from hydrogen to human. And so somewhere along the way, they said, well, let's take it down. In the year 2000, they published that even on paper, they couldn't go below 200 genes. On the 6th of January 2006 in Nature, they published that in reality, you could only go down to 397 genes. It's sort of like a car. You see, you have a car, you can take off the bumper, but you can't take out the motor. So a cell, which is where my specialty lies in my scientific work, a cell needs a specific number of components to be functional. You have a membrane, but then you need to feed the membrane. So you have to have some mitochondria. You need a way of tagging the proteins. You need some DNA. So you need 397 things. Just the glucose cycle for getting energy takes over six different genes. So if you don't have one of them, you don't have any more energy coming to the cell. So we have 397 genes. So you have to go from 0 to 397 in one shot for the simplest cell. There is no reductionist ability to go below that. So you, when we talk about, it's not religious to say a computer is created. That's not a religious statement. Saying who has created it might be. But saying a computer is created is not a religious statement. We have things that are put together. You take the parts of the material, put it together, boom, it works as a computer. Here we have a cell. We have to have all the pieces together.
So you're saying that the science has effectively imploded in trying to prove or reveal evolution. They can't get to the origin of
anything.
Well, here's the thing. Now, this is where Lawrence has unleashed his key argument here. And in this thing that he talks about debating evolutionists and never losing, mm-hmm. he always goes straight to origin of life. And what he does with that is he says, okay, here we're going to talk about something that has to do with the origin of life. At some point, this evolutionist, which I don't really like that word, is going to say something about science not knowing everything about the origin of life. And he goes back and says, haha, the evolutionist has said they don't know everything about the origin of life. And
just tell me the origin of anything. How about an insect without wings getting to an insect with wings? Come on, origin of anything. Eyes, ears, nose, anything.
Lawrence, now you're talking about the origin of life. Now, the origin of life has nothing, the fact that science doesn't know everything about the origin of life does not mean that all of that evolution that we do know quite a bit about, from the fossil record, from genetic information, from comparative anatomy.
You can't get the origin of anything genetically, Jason. You can't
yes,
get the origin of
you
anything.
Can.
You've got two processes. You've got natural selection, which isn't even functional before the first cell. You've got mutations, but you don't have any genetic code to mutate. So you've got to go from that 0 to 397. It's not something that's going to be discovered. It's something we know. If you take a computer, we know it's been created. If you take a chair, we know. It's not because I don't know something. It's because I know something, I'm a creationist. Everything that has information and is complex has to have been created.
That's not true at all. So here's where we want to go with this. Now, first of all, you're making that leap right into faith, right? As a matter of fact, you're taking the faith and then trying to leap it onto everything else, right? So when we're talking about evolution and the origin of life, right, even Darwin himself was talking about the evolution being the mechanism by which the diversity of life had come. But if you read the very last paragraph on the origin of species, he talks about how the first organisms were breathed into by their creator, and all of this evolution happened after that. Right, so all of this evolutionary science, this evolutionary history, comes after, for the most part, the origin of life. Right.
Show me one textbook in the school, one textbook that doesn't start with the Big Bang, which is long.
Many of them don't start with the Big Bang.
All the biology textbooks we have in Quebec and Canada start with the Big Bang. They go through Miller's primordial soup, and trying to suggest to students that somehow amino acids could form proteins in water, which dissolves, and in heat, which also breaks down. Then the RNA somehow magically appears, even though it's only in lipids, even though they only appear within living
cells. Actually, it doesn't say anything about them magically appearing. And as a matter of fact, most of them don't start with the Big Bang. They start with the nature of science and the scientific method, which is pretty much limited to the physical world, even by your definition, right?
Exactly. So the physical world shows us that RNA and lipids, fat molecules for those who don't know, RNA and lipids only show up out of living cells. They've never shown up outside. They only get created by living cells. So you're suggesting
you're
something that doesn't exist, something, an environment
not
that's hypothetical. That's a religious statement. You can't show me that environment in a lab. It's a religious statement.
Well, here's the thing. That's where science doesn't say, oh, we know what happened. See, science being limited to the physical world, what we can do is say, here are some things that fit with what we observe here, astronomical observations, what's going on other planets, what kinds of materials do we think might have been here. Now, sure, we can't say, yes, this is exactly what happened, right? But we can come up with plausible atmospheres. We can come up with plausible things. There are a lot of abiotic.
Give me a plausible atmosphere. Give me a plausible atmosphere. what I'm saying here is this. I'm not doing this to be facetious, and I don't want to be mean on you, Jason. But the situation is this. There's a lot of faith in evolutionary statements that are in the textbooks, even though it may be that maybe people higher up in evolution aren't making those statements. Stephen Gould, I mean, he was very straightforward. He said, look, when I look at the fossil record, I see stasis, I see sudden appearance. He was just honest. All his life, he looked for that line for clams. He never found it. But he was honest. He remained an evolutionist. He had some creationists who worked under him. Kurt Wise gave him a doctorate in paleontology.
Right. Now, Kurt Wise is an interesting person because he will tell you, oh, yes, all of the data, all of the physical data, all of the physical evidence shows evolution, evolution, evolution. Now, he is a young Earth creationist,
he won't say that the data says this, but my
faith in a literal interpretation of the Bible.
I spoke with Kurt Wise. He told me. That he and Dr. Gould just agreed to disagree. He does not at all think. I've heard him give conferences where he explains the data in a total different way, and explain fossils, because all we have fossils, we don't have any dating on them. But let's go back to the question here is this. DNA is the focus of life. Everything in life, I mean, this is the most complex thing on the earth. We're talking about the origin of life, we're talking about the evolution of life. You have to have a DNA code. So, okay, let's say you don't know how to get the DNA code. Let's say it just appears somehow. Okay, that makes us sort of creationist or perhaps a hopeful evolutionist. And then we have the DNA code. Well, where did the information come that's on the DNA code? The DNA code program itself? I work for Hewlett Packard. I can guarantee I've never seen a program itself, ever. I'm a creationist because of what I see, not what I don't see.
So what you're doing is you're saying, since I don't understand it.
I do understand it. A program requires a programmer. A book requires an author. A poem requires a poet requires a poem.
Before we break, you understand it. The origin is surely belief in God. God created the earth. That can't be a position of understanding. That has to be one of faith. And I may share it.
Understanding is in the sense that if I have a computer in front of me or a chair, I understand it's created.
You've said that. But you understand creation.
No. I don't understand all of creation.
Well, that's what you said.
Okay, what I meant was that the concept of having, when you have information involved with an organism, whether it's a chair, a computer, or a cell, the information has to come from outside, so it speaks
seems
to
me, we've got half the show to go, but it seems to me that you can attempt to make succeed in proving him wrong, but you cannot prove creation. You have to, at some point, believe.
Of course.
It may be likely, it may be very likely, it may be unlikely. But
yeah, no, there's a question. What I think in science classes, for instance, unlike some American positions, I don't think you should teach evolution in science classes. I don't think you should teach, when I say evolution, I'm talking about the hydrogen to human evolution. I don't think you should teach creation, six-day creation in science classes. I think you should teach intelligent design, which just says, things look as if they've been intelligent, created, and we'll stop there.
You wouldn't have this on City TV, would you? Back in a few moments on the Michael Curran Show. We're only halfway through. A lot more to say and to hear.
Ground transportation provided by JP Motor Sales, located at 2320 Fairview Street in Burlington.
We're back halfway through, and at halftime we reintroduce the panel, just two of them this time, but they're doing pretty well. Jason Wiles, he's manager, the Evolution Education Research Center at McGill University, and Lawrence Tisdale is president, Creation Science Association in Quebec. We both of them in from Quebec because we feel that if a new Liberal Party leader wants to be part of two countries, then what? Anyway, let's get on with it. Creation, evolution being the issue. I mean, I must admit, much of what is being said here, frankly, I don't understand, because my scientific education is minimal, but it sounds relatively compelling. Most of the people, and I'll be honest with both of you, most of the people I've heard argue for young Earth and literal creation, they've been pretty dumb. I mean, they're almost caricatures of a position, and that may be what media does, that may be what television does. It'll go for someone who's very raw and callow, but this sounds a very informed scientific proposition. Is it?
Not really.
Okay.
But I think Lawrence has become very polished at making it sound that way, and a lot of people have. There are a lot of very, very sophisticated efforts to make it sound that way. Lawrence has made a lot of claims today, a lot of scientific claims. Now, I can't jump on them immediately, and I'm not always the best one to call into question for that. If you want to go back through the show and pick out all of the claims that he made, there are wonderful places to go. TalkOrigins.org has a whole list of creationist claims, and Lawrence has brought in nothing new. This is all things that creationists have been saying for time after time after time, and this particular index of creationist claims goes with peer-reviewed references and says, no, and this is why. It's very good. So when my debate skills fail here, I would...
You're doing very well. Let's talk about young Earth. So it's 10,000 years. Is that the claim from your side?
That would be the claim from the creation, what we call young Earth creationists.
Okay. Are you part of that?
I am.
Okay.
But I represent, in terms of debating stuff, a more just a very global thing, because I feel that's it's a more...
pretty important, though.
Oh, it is. No, I feel it's very important to recognize that the basic laws of science are against evolution.
I don't think so. If the basic laws of science were against evolution, then why would all of these scientists be using the basic laws of science
Let's talk about some basic laws. Laws of biogenesis. Life comes from life. So why are we teaching life comes from non-life?
Life comes from life in our particular atmosphere and environment today, right? Now, science doesn't know everything about the origin of life.
So
and I see you going, see him going right back to the origin of life
again. We'll talk about the young Earth,
I'll get him back to that.
But it's so important that the law, I mean, I can go through five different laws quickly. We don't have, because of an hour goes by really quickly, but I can go through five basic laws that high school science that shows evolution is dead, it's wrong. And
So is there a conspiracy? Is there a plot by people who are opposed to creation?
No, but I do think that...
And why is it happening? Why is the overwhelming majority of people in the field of science and education opposed to it?
And why, when we do a survey, is there only 9 or 15% that believe it?
Oh, for goodness sake, people believe Elvis Presley is still alive. People still vote for the Liberal Party. It doesn't mean anything, does it?
It's considered, but no, it does mean
We're not talking about a survey of what people think about a subject they know hardly anything about. We're speaking about people who are relative experts in their field, scientists and teachers.
religious. Yeah. And the vast majority, the vast majority are opposed to your position.
Agreed. Right. I see certain aspects of my position. When a lot of them, most scientists don't deal with evolution. I mean, if you're a chemist, or when I was doing my master's in roses and specialty in cloning roses, what did it have to do with evolution? It had nothing to do with evolution. And so most
Actually,
of us just have a position.
To be honest, now your degree is from the agricultural faculty, is that correct?
Yeah, phytotechnology. Yeah, science.
Right. Okay. I actually spoke with Donald Smith, who is actually the head of that department at McGill, and I asked him. I said, are there any people, any professors in your faculty, in your department, that are teaching creationism or young earth creationism or anything having to do with this? And he says, absolutely not. We're not doing anything like that. And as a matter of fact, we teach that past evolution of these organisms that we work with has a lot to do with what we're able to do with them now and the diversity that they have.
Which is why when I was there, Dr. Spiracy, who was one, I don't know if he's still on faculty there, but he was on faculty, during the class, I brought up a few questions concerning what he was saying about changes of ecological systems and evolving them, and I said, no, that's not evolution. It's based on what's already there as information. And he told me, Lawrence, okay, you don't have to put evolution in your final exam. See, people haven't studied the subject. I feel a lot of people have just been conned into believing.
Let's bring it back to young Earth, and whether you want to or not. You believe that the world is 10,000 years old.
I do.
I don't understand all the details of carbon dating and dating of rocks and fossils and so on, but why is it that so few people seem to agree with that? Even people who are serious Christians think the world is much, much older. And I suppose that would also assume that humans and dinosaurs coexisted.
It would. It would.
Really?
Yeah. And some still do exist together.
What exactly is your evidence of this?
That human dinosaurs still coexist?
That they have ever coexisted.
Ever coexisted. Well, I was going to bring it on, but I didn't. We have footprints of humans with dinosaurs in Dakota. We have dinoglyphs from Lake in the Woods in Ontario all the way down to Peru.
Dinoglyphs being
drawings of dinosaurs.
Right. Just like there are native drawings of all kinds of fantastic creatures.
Yeah, but these aren't fantastic. They're consistent. And in fact, the one that we showed before
yes,
the show
yeah.
Happens to show a Tyrannosaurus rex with a neck frill. And neck frills, these things are, these rocks were documented by the Spaniards in 1600s. This shows a neck frill, and we've only just discovered since 1992 that Tyrannosaurus rex have neck frills because they don't fossilize.
We have some drawings that people have done that look like they might be of things
that
they
don't look like they might be. Go to our website.
So other than the glyphs, what do you have?
Well, we have thousands of glyphs. We've got people. We've got human tracks.
Are we talking about Paluxy River tracks?
No, I'm talking about in Dakota. There's
a Zapata track, perhaps?
No. The one that's in Dakota, there's a Zapata track. There's the one in Dakota.
I really find this very interesting. You actually brought that one on the 100 Huntley Street show. I find it so difficult to believe that you even bring things like this up. I've talked to many people who have seen pictures of this thing and say, oh my goodness, this is such an obvious forgery. Our Canada Research Chair.
This is evolutionary. This is evolutionary. Did you speak to Don Patton?
Finish the response, please.
Right. By the way, this track that he's talking about has never been put forth as something that is described for publication in science. But they bring it around. He brought it on himself, a cast of this thing. Right, and you show this to a paleontologist, you show this to a podiatrist, and it's supposedly a human track from supposedly the Permian era, right, before dinosaurs, before humans, and just these people will look at this, these experts will say without any background, this is something that Lawrence Tisdale showed. No, it's like, what is this? That's an obvious forgery. Right?
Why would it be obvious? Because they have a predisposition towards there not being a footprint there.
We're going to break. Back in a few moments. Michael Cronje, a lot more to talk about dinosaurs. It gets interesting now. Don't go away or we'll eat you. We'll see you very soon.
I've seen Jurassic Park. I've even seen the sequels, and so I know about this subject. So creation, evolution is the theme, and dinosaurs and human coexistence. I have read relatively extensively in the field of classical literature, and if dinosaurs were roaming through the major cities of ancient empires, it would be memorable. Now, I know there are some references. We spoke about them before the show. But generally speaking, the great authors of that period do not mention that the presence of large man-eating monsters in Rome or Greece or Babylon or Jerusalem or anywhere else.
They're mentioned. I wouldn't expect dinosaurs to be in heavily urban areas. They aren't today. Today we have the Mekele and Mbembe. We have Tongamatu. We have a Ropan, which is a reptile, flying reptile in New Guinea, which is described exactly the same way in Kenya and in the Cameroon. I have a friend, Bill Gibbons, who's been to Africa 8 times. I think he's been around.
I know him.
He's been 8 times. He's going back. He's trying to get the pictures.
See, this is where I have some problems, because I know some of the stuff that you're talking about, and I don't think it's actually very convincing. We're talking about those big guys, you know, big guys with the long necks whose names keep changing, with Allosaurus or Brontosaurus or whatever. They're not. Hard to miss them.
Sure it is. In a swamp that's over the size of Florida, you can go there for 3 weeks and not even see an elephant.
I don't think I've ever really read a mention of these creatures in any of the classical writers.
How about a helicopter? Or how about satellite imagery? I mean, we can read license plates from space, but you can't see something.
There's all kinds of areas on Earth that haven't been explored and that are still being explored, and I predict we're going to find a living dinosaur, but this is, we're a long way from evolution creation, I think.
But there are claims here.
You owe me a dollar.
Claims about how old, you say 10,000 years, which doesn't necessitate the belief in the coexistence of humans and dinosaurs.
Yes.
That's a fundamental point, and I think even a layperson can have an opinion here that it seems incredibly unlikely that there are so few, if any, mentions of dinosaurs existing at the time when the ancients were living and writing.
We're going to bring a show on dinosaurs, but I could bring you out the material where there are. Herodias mentions it, Alexander the Great mentioned it, Marco Polo mentions it, the Bible has 7 dinosaurs mentioned, or big beasts, the behemoth, the leviathan. The behemoth in Job chapter 40 sits down in the river Jordan and drinks the whole river. Seems to me like that's a pretty big beast. And it's the principle of God's creations.
There's no metaphor in the Old Testament.
It's not considered a metaphor, because God is explaining to Job that he's God and Job's Job, and everything God says in those chapters, chapter 40, 41, in fact, the 3 chapters before that, are all concerning real, natural events, and God's saying, look at my creation, I'm the creator, and you're not.
I believe in the absolute truth of God's book. I also believe in the absolute reality of metaphor used by the creator. I find this a very difficult one. You also mentioned the drawings of dinosaurs. Now, some of them, are very convincing in a way, but I've also seen quite a few drawings of UFOs. Okay. And I think people who believe in UFOs, frankly, are nuts. But there are a lot of people who say, look at these ancient drawings, and there's a UFO, and there's an alien. Does that mean I have to believe in...
You don't have a consistency over 1,500 years of drawings. There's a difference here. Dinoglyphs, we can go back over 1,500 years, right up to within 500 years, and we have the same creatures being drawn.
Wouldn't the human imagination, particularly one at that period of time, embrace ideas of the huge, monstrous, terrifying creature?
But why are they being so consistent in their drawings?
Some of them are pretty clumsy. They're just big animals.
If you look at all the drawings over all of the different archaeological finds, they're not going to be all of dinosaurs that look just like dinosaurs. I mean, there's probably tens of thousands of different drawings of different creatures, and maybe some of them happen to look like what some dinosaurs look like. It's not very convincing to me, and it's not convincing to science. Now, if we're going to talk about science, let's talk about science. I'm not exactly sure you wanted to talk about here.
We've already talked about the theory of information at Harvard, showing that information has to come from outside a system. So how do you explain, why are you teaching as an evolutionist that we can have a system without that programs itself?
Well, first of all, I'm not necessarily teaching anything about anybody programming anything. What we're talking about is what...
You're an evolutionist. You believe that the DNA code programmed itself.
Now, he's using this evolutionist word.
And you're avoiding my question.
Right. Well,
my question is very clear here. DNA is...
Why do you object to evolutionists?
Because I think what it tries to do, as you're saying, evolutionist, I think when he calls me that, I think he's trying to infer something about my particular set of religious beliefs, worldview, what have you. And no one's ever asked me on this show yet what it is that I actually believe or what my background happens to be. As a matter of fact, I grew up in the southern United States. My undergraduate degree was from Harding University, which is an extremely conservative, very, very, very fundamentalist Christian university. And I actually was a young earth creationist for a very long period of time, and it was the actual scientific data and my own road of discovery that led me, like so many others, to accept evolution. It's not a belief on my part. There's actually quite a bit of literature in educational psychology regarding belief and acceptance. So I accept evolution based on the physical evidence that is there, not because of what I was taught to believe.
Let's start examining your evidence, because I give a few of my evidences, just a few. You talked about you're an evolutionist, you went from being creationist to an evolutionist based on some evidence. Start one at a time, let's talk about them.
Okay, well, I don't have to defend the veracity of evolution.
We can break now and for 30 seconds of the commercials and then come back if you prefer that, because we're about at that clear. Would that be better?
Better, that's fine. I can talk about evidence if you'd like.
All right. We'll break here and they can fight in the commercial break. We'll sell you some shampoo or whatever it is and then come straight back to us, don't you? There you go, well, there's nothing else worth watching.
If you would like to contact The Michael Koren Show, please write to The Michael Koren Show at 1295 North Service Road, Burlington, Ontario, L7R4X5, or send an email to info@michaelkoren.com. If you would like to know more about CTS-TV, we invite you to visit our website at ctstv.com.
Welcome back to Michael Koren Show. Creation, evolution is the subject, and you've been challenged, evidence for your point of view.
Right, and the evidence is so vast that there's probably not much of a way that I'm going to be able to get through it. If the viewers are really interested in learning about the evidence, there's a great book by a couple of Canadians, both started out young earth creationists. One got his PhD at McGill in paleontology, the other got a PhD in theology at Boston College. It's now the...
Boston College. Right. No wonder he doesn't believe anything.
Right, but the thing is, they are both evangelical Christians, and the theologist that I'm talking about here is actually the minister of the University Baptist Church in Michigan, at the University of Michigan.
Right. So just a couple of points, if you might not read the book.
Okay. By the way, it's called Paradigms on Pilgrimage. Okay. Very, very good book. There's a ton of evidence, right? The evidence from the fossil record is very, very compelling. It's extraordinarily compelling. The evidence from biochemistry is extraordinarily compelling, and it corroborates the fossil evidence, right? So all of the things that we saw going on in the fossil record, we look now with our abilities with genetics and say, oh my goodness, yes, these things are as related as we thought they were, or in cases where we weren't exactly sure, they helped to clarify those things. The comparative anatomy has been around for a long time, looking at these kinds of organisms where we can tell based on their morphological structures, how they are related, which is again corroborated by the genetic information.
False. Comparative anatomy, that's false. You have a major in biology, you should be ashamed.
Yes.
Comparative anatomy is not the same genes. You've got the famous pictures of the different, of the four limbs of the different species, whether it's bats, humans, horse, etc. Not the same genes. De Beer told it in the 40s, it's not the same genes, 40 years ago,
Oh, sure.
That are producing this. No, and the hind legs don't work. That's
what's
wrong.
There? No, well, behind legs. What are you talking about?
Well, you've got forearms. You say, oh, we can see we come from a similar ancestor because we have similar bone formations in our forearms.
Oh, but similar. They're exactly the same bones.
No, they aren't exactly the same bones, but they're different genes. They are different genes. You said we have a genetic evidence. The genetic evidence points against that.
No,
secondly,
it,
you said, let's
go
back to the fossil record. You want to tell us, let's go for the most recent, because evolutionists like to do experimentation on bacteria that have been stable for 3.55 billion years. It's a strange thing to do experimentation on evolution on. But let's talk about monkeys to humans. Monkeys to humans, supposed to be, or ancestor to a chimpanzee, would look like a chimp, would be last million years. How do you change the 250 or more differences between chimps and monkeys? Just get them walk upright. You've got to change the inner ear. You've got to change the muscular structure, the backbone, the hip, the knee, to get it walk upright. And a monkey that walks upright isn't going to be a good monkey, isn't going to walk around the trees very well. Genetically, I'm a geneticist. Explain to me a genetic pathway to do this.
Well, what we're dealing here with here is a combination of genetics and development, right? These are things that these big changes that look like big changes aren't really that big changes as far as the DNA, but more in development. There's a whole emerging science of developmental evolution. It's really a brilliant study.
You're not on the same planet I am.
Yes, of course I am. So when you're dealing with something like something that we know has come from common ancestry, something like a Chihuahua versus a Great Dane. Very, very, very big differences in the shapes of all of these different bones, right? But it's to the eye, right?
But they come from an archetype, a dog or wolf archetype that breached out. That's no problem. Creationist evolutionists are all equal in that. What we're saying is you're not going to get from apes to humans. You're not.
What's the difference between apes to humans?
Massive differences. Look, we got the knees are different. Okay, they get a knee to walk upright by some miracle.
It's still genetic change.
Well, we have to have the inner ear to use
it. It's still developmental change. It's still biological change that we're talking about.
The thing is, you do not have any example, or we do not yet have any example of new information caused by new genes.
Absolutely. And if you go to talkorigins.com and you
go to talkorigins.org,
you pick that particular
website and battling it out very quickly. Carbon dating, can't rely on it.
Carbon dating?
Yeah.
Any dating. How do you know what was there to begin with? You don't. Carbon dating, here's what's interesting. Carbon dating, you can rely on it for about 2,000-3,000 years, and then it starts really going away from the known historic dates. But here's the maximum for carbon dating, about 100,000 years.
You can really rely on it for those times.
For about 2,000-3,000 years.
You can really rely on it.
You can rely because you can test. You have a way of going back saying, okay, this is historically, archaeologically,
right.
We know
well,
the
why
age.
Why can you not go back any farther?
Because we've noticed, it was a research done in the University of Munich, you notice that as you're going back past 3,000 years, the difference becomes larger and larger between the carbon-14 dates and the real historic archaeological dates. But what's interesting, I just want to
finish in the face about this. But if you take the carbon dating and you take the tree ring data, the dendrochronology, you can match those straight up. 11,000 years, that takes your 10,000 years right out of the water there.
Well, 11,000 years, we're not talking 65 million. There are answers to that we don't have time to get on to, but let's finish on the carbon dating because I want to finish
very
on
quick.
Carbon dating, what do we do with the fact that we find significant amounts of radioactive carbon, which means it's young, in virtually all strata of rock. 15,000 samples reported in the journal Radiocarbon, showing that it couldn't be. You have coal that's supposed to be 300 million years old, and it has significant amounts of carbon-14, which shows that it has to be less than 50,000
years old. There are radioactive.
We've got to get Rick,
monkeys
and people. You should see me trying to dance. Back in a few moments on the Michael Curran Show. We'll see you soon. Emails and hugs and all that. We'll see.
Email from Phil King in Ola, Quebec. Here we go again, more talk about reopening the same-sex marriage legislation. I'm so sick of hearing about this over and over. What's next? A debate on slavery or women voting? Yeah, exactly, that's what we'll have next. I mean, come on, we're not talking about a human right here. We're talking about a social value. And also a piece of legislation that was, I think, really pushed by media
by powerful people, by courts, and elected politicians. Anyway, more of that at another time, I'm sure. Jude Samuels, thank you so very much for being here. And Lawrence Tisdale, thank you so very much for being here. I don't know what you concluded, which side you're on, but it was worth having that debate. Tomorrow, that was the week that was. Until then, take care, God bless, and goodbye.
Michael Corrin's wardrobe supplied by Stollery's, serving Canada's business community for over 100 years. Stollery's at Bloor and Yonge.